Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we share with you a talk by New York Times bestselling author David Talbot. His latest book, Between Heaven and Hell, The Story of My Stroke. David Talbot recently spoke at Copperfields Books in Petaluma, California. David Talbot, Between Heaven and Hell. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back to the show David Talbot. David Talbot is an acclaimed journalist, best-selling author, and founder of Salon Magazine. He's brought us masterful and explosive stories for over 25 years with books like the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Devil's Chessboard, and the nationally recognized Season of the Witch. Now, for the first time, political commentator and historian Talbot turns inward. In this intimate journey through the life-changing year following his stroke, he talks about his five-week recovery at the Ralph Davies Medical Center in San Francisco. This is an illuminating portrait of how a health crisis can profoundly shift one's perspective on life and the meaning of existence. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, Dennis Murphy, and John Bertucci. Here is David Talbot.
Thank you all for coming out. Some of you have already begun asking yourselves the existential questions, maybe because of your age, or your health, or you're just prone to reveries about human existence. Questions like, when will I die? Is there any meaning to the life I've lived? What should I do with whatever time remains for me on Earth? It took a stroke that I suffered 2 years ago at the age of 66 to compel me to think in a deep, sustained way about my own mortality and about the much larger questions of life and death in capital letters. The existential questions that tend to get buried in most Americans' frantic rush to do and spend and enjoy and to avoid boredom and suffering and anxiety. But death is a shadow that we can't outrun. It's a constant companion that we must learn to accept and even welcome as part of our lives. As the founder of the pioneering online publication Salon, and later as a New York Times bestselling author, I've been known through most of my life as a probeer of power and politics in books like Brothers, Devil's Chessboard, and Season of the Witch. But I've never searched deeply inside myself as a writer until my own massive stroke in 2017 forced me to examine my suddenly precarious existence and why I was still on Earth. I began tapping out my internal explorations and my newly acute observations about the world around me while I was still very much in recovery. I felt half dead because a small part of my brain had indeed died. The part that controls rather essential functions, such as swallowing, speaking, seeing, standing, and walking. I could barely type, with my right hand more a clumsy claw than something human. But I was on fire to capture my vanishing existence, which had left me strangely ecstatic. My ordeal, I told loved ones gathered around my hospital bed, felt like a cross between a brutal barroom beating and a spiritual awakening. I felt this way even though I'm a firmly unreligious person. Despite my thoroughly secular identity, I felt transcendent. I'd been stuck in a late midlife trough, bent with obligations and woes, like most people, when the lightning bolt cracked open my head, letting in a flood of light. My stroke did not just change my life, it saved my life. In Between Heaven and Hell, I try to convey what it's like to have a stroke and to survive one, or rather, what my stroke felt like. Like Tolstoy's unhappy families, I've learned that each stroke is unhappy or terrifying and hallucinatory in its own unique way. Different strokes for different folks. To quote Sly Stone, if you have survived something as profound as a medical trauma, you must not try to return to your old life. That life is gone forever. But as I write in the book, this rupture with your past can be a kind of rapture. Your new life has begun, and it can be deeper. And yet, in my experience, there are no grand lessons to be gleaned from survival. Some die, some survive. Suffering is literally meaningless. As cancer patient Christian Wiman has written in his own recent memoir, it's devoid of meaning. It's easy, though, to fall into the narcissism of suffering, but that only invites pity and a sense of obligation from others. I don't want to live the rest of my life in those doldrums. I've come to conclude that the only power left to me, left to us, as victims of medical trauma, is what concentration camp survivor Viktor Frankl described in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, as, quote, the last of human freedoms. The freedom to choose one's attitude in dire circumstances, in the most dire circumstances, in his case, at Auschwitz. And so I learned to live with whatever is left of my dwindling life with what I call, quote, a stoic exuberance. I'm a child of the 1960s, so I belong to no church or state. My philosophy collage has been pieced together from many sources and mentors, but they all share my stoic exuberance about life and death. Marcus Aurelius, one of the original Stoics, Montaigne, Camus, Thomas Merton, the great Catholic philosopher, Ram Dass, who just recently died, George Harrison. My mother, Paula Talbot, was another closer to home inspiration. I write about her a little in the book. I've been thinking about her a lot lately. A singer and an actress as a young woman, she gave up show business to raise her four children. She was a producer of life and joy, and we were her production. But when her brood, or her cast, began disappearing to college, she took her first job in the real world in quotes, as a desk clerk in the kidney dialysis unit at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. Now, in those years, kidney disease was a death sentence. The dialysis machines that cleaned the kids' blood on a scheduled basis would keep them alive for months or even a few years, long enough for the children to work their way into my mother's embrace. Her powerful hugs were restorative, but not long enough for them to reach adulthood. It was a workplace of suffering and inevitable death. And it was filled with boys and girls who should have just been starting life. But my mother, with her boundless spirit, became the heart and soul of that grim horde. She cheered up inconsolable parents, and she befriended all the terminally sick kids. She would accompany them as they were wheeled into surgery, holding their hands and singing show tunes for them as they went into surgery. I often wonder these days how my mother could have possibly worked in this place of doom for over 16 years, until she herself was felled by a series of strokes that would eventually kill her. It must be because she had a rare gift, one that I myself now need and envy. My mother could fully love life while being intimate every day of her life with death. She saw no contradiction in this strange duality. I think coming home from the chamber where she routinely said farewell to death's youngest victims filled her own heart with more love for her own children and for life itself. I also write in my book about George Harrison, the quote, deep beetle, who was said to have prepared for death his entire adult life. George knew that, quote, life flows on within you and without you. A mind-blowing and mind-expanding concept for a 15-year-old like me when I first heard that haunting song on the Sgt. Pepper's album. But Harrison, who died of metastatic lung cancer at 58, also thoroughly enjoyed the material world, happily indulging in all the pleasures afforded a world-famous rock star. Like my mother, he too saw no contradiction between a life fully lived and a life with a termination date. at least termination in this reality. My memoir is an appropriately short book. Whatever wisdom about the meaning of life and death I have to convey is condensed and by design entertaining to read. But in telling my life story in a simple but thoughtful way, I try to arrest readers' attention. Like the late Ram Dass, a spiritual guide for my generation who also suffered a stroke at age 66 and survived, I'm telling people to be here now. Stop. Reflect. Remind yourself that you are here and that, yes, life goes on within you and without you. Make your life and your death mean something. And that's my opening. You know, I have one more thing, if you'll be patient with me. I would like to read something short from the book to tell you about the life I led that led to my stroke, which I think is important. When talking about stop and reflect on your life, I should have reflected on this earlier in my life, obviously, before I had a stroke. But this gives you the sense of how I felt that stress was a part of a combative life. And there's no way, I think, to be an independent journalist in this country and be constantly tilting at windmills, constantly trying to fundraise and fight powers much bigger than yourself, and know at the end of the day that you're only going to change history in small ways. I went into journalism with the greatest of motives as a crusader, and at some point you realize your accomplishments are going to be rather small ones, and maybe you're not even going to be aware of them while you live. So I want to tell you what it was like a little bit, and it's kind of funny, the story. What it was like for me, it's long, if you'll bear with me. It's in the book, so you can read more about that in this chapter called Riding the Dragon, which is how it felt to run a little salon, this media startup during the dot-com era and during the Clinton impeachment. Hey, we're back in the impeachment mode, so it's relevant. Here we go. Actually, because coming out of a chapter where I talked about, quote, how Hollywood almost gave me a stroke, that's a whole other story. Actually, my high-stress career began years before the Hollywood Mad Tea Party back in 1995, launched Salon, one of America's first online publications, at the dawn of the wild.com roller coaster ride. I could easily have suffered a stroke or a heart attack any time during the 10 years I served as Salon editor-in-chief and chairman of the board, a dual editorial and business role that allowed me to protect the journalistic integrity of my creation, but unfortunately subjected me to all the joys and horrors of the brave new digital era. At some point in a high anxiety career, you have to ask yourself, am I prepared to die for this? Is this truly worth my life? Eventually, you will have to answer that question. It is a life or death question that, depending on how you answer it, can make your mark on the world or can kill you. This stark truth hit me one afternoon in fall 1998 while sitting at my desk in the corner office of Salon, which at the time occupied a former art gallery above Rochester Big and Tall Men's Clothing Store in downtown San Francisco. I was anxiously awaiting a business visit from John Warnick, co-founder of the software giant Adobe and the biggest investor in Salon. Warnick was a courteous, middle-aged man with a professorial beard and a thoughtful manner to match. He was not your typical robotic Silicon Valley engineering mogul. He had clearly invested millions of his own money in Salon, not strictly as a business venture, but because he also cared about free speech and the future of American journalism. But Warnick was still a businessman, and he had the power of life and death over my shaky startup, which, like all dot-com publishing ventures, was still struggling to find a stable business model. About an hour before Warnick was due to arrive, I swallowed a pill. One pill makes you larger. I swallowed a pill that my doctor had prescribed to help me quell my galloping anxieties. I had tried one or two other medications at the time to calm my nerves and to help me sleep at night, but none of them made much difference. This one did. In an emphatic way. I passed out at my desk, waking moments later with a racing heart and a profound sense of disorientation. Flushed and sweating, I walked in a daze through the field of cubicles that jammed our office, heading for the rooms of my two top editorial colleagues, Andrew Ross and Gary Kimia. I remember the faces of the young salon employees who all looked up at me as I went rushing by, which they usually did, searching for some sign of how the company was faring by the either giddy or anguished look on my face. This was not a good time to be making eye contact with me. Daddy looked like a wreck. Bursting in on a news meeting between Ross and Camille, my longtime friends and journalistic partners, I announced in a strangled voice that I thought I was having a heart attack. They looked as stricken as I felt. They quickly called for an ambulance, even though I knew the timing was terrible. What about Warnick? The future of Salon's funding depended on a smooth business meeting, a meeting scheduled to begin in just minutes. But my life apparently was at stake. As we were waiting for the ambulance, I felt I might lose consciousness at any moment, and I breathlessly begged Gary to look out for Camille and her two young boys. Then we heard the ambulance screech to a halt outside the building with sirens wailing. As two burly emergency medical technicians strapped me onto a gurney and prepared to wheel me to the elevator, Andrew suddenly announced that Warnick had arrived in the downstairs lobby. "Wait," I hissed at the ambulance crew, "you can't take me down in the elevator," even though I thought I was dying. I couldn't bear the idea of Salon's crucial financial supporter seeing the company founder being hauled out of the building on a stretcher. I might or might not actually be dying, but I knew that eye-popping visual would definitely kill Salon. I demanded to be released from the gurney and allowed to walk down the back stairwell to avoid bumping into Warnick on my way out. The medics were aghast. My blood pressure was soaring, and I could die right there. They made me agree to sign a legal release before they unstrapped me. I made it down the stairwell with the medics nervously at my side, and as I was raced to a nearby hospital, Andrew and Gary, along with Salon CEO Michael O'Donnell, were left to explain to Warnick my sudden absence from the crucial meeting. They put on a brilliant show, and fortunately, Warnick was convinced to save Salon by leading another round of investment. Meanwhile, I found myself in the emergency room of St. Francis Hospital, plugged into an electrocardiogram machine. "Are you in a stressful line of work?" the ER doctor asked me. He could see that my heart was fine, but I was probably in the throes of a massive anxiety attack, triggered by the pill I had popped and months of unrelieved work pressure. "You could say that," I replied. "I run a dot-com startup." "Yeah, we see a lot of you guys in here," said the doctor. I could have talked to the doctor for a full hour about all the pressures that were compounding in my life, and I was only 3 years into a frenzied run at Salon. My frantic stairwell exit to the emergency room should have been a cautionary siren for me. Instead, it would become a funny barroom anecdote, another Salon near-death experience. You know, I still talk to my family about that period and whether or not I made the right decision by staying at Salon for a full 10 years and going through the madness of the Clinton impeachment. You know, people think the political madness has begun or Obama or now, but as you recall, it was very insane back then as well, the culture wars, the political wars. And Little Salon broke away from the media pack to cover the vast right-wing conspiracy, as Hillary Clinton labeled it. And by doing so, we were very isolated. The rest of the media hated us. The Republican Party, obviously. I woke up one morning and Tom DeLay, who was the Republican Party whip at the time, was demanding that the FBI investigate Salon. We had advertising boycotts. We had a bomb threat that emptied our office one day, and I had to explain to my staff why they should be brave enough to go back and keep working at Salon. I had death threats. Every time I was on Fox News, which was a lot in those days, Bill O'Reilly loved me. I would have death threats phoned in to me. They had my home phone. I had a landline in those days. And actually, the worst part was my kid. They threatened to kill my kids, too, who were pretty young then. But guess what? Our circulation, paid circulation, which is very unusual, as you know, about online journalism, soared. And we got up to 100,000 people willing to pay $40 a year. $4 million was half our budget. And that's what saved Salon. So that's what I mean, that unfortunately, to actually make a difference, even the small difference we made. And, you know, Clinton has told people, told a good friend of mine, Joe Connison, who used to write for us. Joe was ghostwriting his biography at the time. He said, you know, he was out of the White House, but that salon saved my ass. We did save his ass because we were doing a kind of reporting on his opposition that no one else was. And we were putting his youthful indiscretion, so to speak, in the context by exposing those who were investigating him and their own indiscretions. Washington is a cesspool of sexism and adultery and so on, so it's very ironic to have the Republicans single out that one blowjob as a reason to impeach him. Not the smartest thing in the world for the president, but also not an impeachable act, we felt. So anyway, I would love to open things up and hear from all of you what's on your mind. We'd love to talk about politics, we'd love to talk about survival, love to talk about how you do stay in the game long enough to make a difference in doing independent media, you're taking on big companies, the deep state, whoever you're tilting windmills with. We do have to help each other and give each other support when we find ourselves on the battle lines this way. And one reason I stayed in San Francisco and still stay here and love San Francisco and think it's worth fighting for is because it feels like a bulwark against the madness in the rest of the country. And even though we've been invaded by tech capital and this massive housing displacement and thousands of people thrown on the streets by this onrush of money and capital, San Francisco is fighting back. And we just elected Chesa Boudin as district attorney, which is a major thing. And also, we now control, progressives control the Board of Supervisors, because people like Dean Preston, who's a great ventures, rights advocate lawyer, was elected to the board. So these are my friends and my comrades, my fellow warriors. And, you know, as Ishmael Reed once said, writing is fighting. And so every time I write something on Facebook or write this book, I try to show a little blood, because you do bleed. If you fight in the arena like I've been fighting, like a lot of you have been fighting, you bleed, and it takes something out of you. The stroke, you know, I was kind of a walking bombshell in a way. I was heavier, I had high blood pressure, so I had all the risk factors when it hit me. But it was a constant stress, too, chronic stress, that also produced a toxic mix for me. Looking back, I wish I could have learned to be more meditative in things I do now, and take time out and pause. I meditate every morning. I do things that should have been natural for someone in my generation, coming out of the counterculture, going to school in Santa Cruz. But I got caught up in the madness of the times, the frenzy, having kids, having a family, things we all do. And I wasn't able to pause enough for myself and take care of myself enough to prevent that from happening. But in the end, something's going to kill you. So that's why I say I try to live every day of my life now in a way that's meaningful, that I can be proud of. I'm so happy that I lived long enough to see my son, Joe Talbot, make The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which he made last year. And I think this very night a year ago, I was on my cane up at Sundance in the ice and snow because Joe's film was debuting there, and it got a standing ovation, and Joe won Best Director Award at Sundance. That was the beginning. He's down in Hollywood right now at the Directors Guild of America ceremony. That film stars a young man named Jimmy Fails, who he also took in and also helped raise. So I'm duly proud of the two of them. They're a team, Jimmy and Joe. And Joe and Jimmy always had an ability to do something that it seems like we should have nailed down our generation, should be obvious. They crossed race lines. And Joe was very comfortable with young black kids all the time. And Jimmy became very comfortable with the white family that raised him. And so this sort of easy racial tone of that film, I think, comes from this unique band of young artists, Asian, black, Latino, white, who all worked together to make that film. Joe was more proud of the other award he won at Sundance, which was the Best Ensemble Award, Creative Ensemble. And they were all up on that stage. And that was San Francisco at its best, this multicultural rainbow of young filmmakers, every race, all young, saying, we made this film together. So we have our victories. And when it seems darker sometimes, like we keep electing these monsters from our generation, George W. Bush, Donald Trump, they're our generation, mine. But there are these other victories that keep my spirits up, that I think keep me going. And this year was particularly, I think, inspiring for me. Not my work, but seeing the torch pass to younger creative people. Anyway, I've talked enough. Let's hear from you. Yes, here.
You wrote so lovingly about all your caregivers in the hospitals, and I'm wondering if you kept any relationships continuing from those people.
Yeah, thank you for asking. You all heard that, right? Yeah. Yes, they became my family for the 5 weeks I was at Davies. If you've been for any length in a hospital, you know what a strange and eerie world it can be and how lonely it can be and scary. And I describe some of the scary nights, dementia patients screaming all night. It felt like hell to be in hell. And your family can't be there 24/7. I was there 5 weeks. It's a long haul. My wife's mother was dying at the same time, so she was also having to take care of that. So they were my family. And of course, some of them are not so great. Some of them are short-tempered. I talked about one doctor who was a complete, I'll tell the story, he was a complete The biggest thing you fear, of course, because my mother never came back. My mother, who was this amazing person, the first stroke took the part of her brain that removed her identity. So she came home a different person. She was a child. And each stroke took more from her. So my worst fear, of course, was that I would lose that part of my brain, not just mechanical skills, but who I was, my identity, and that suddenly my family would have to adjust to that. That's weird. I told Joe, the one who's in the hospital, I was kind of serious. I grabbed him by the arm and said, Joe, I just don't want to come back as a Donald Trump supporter. Luckily, I didn't. That part remained the same.
There is a gun.
But anyway, to get back to these people, some of the doctors are arrogant, as we all know. Brain surgeons can be very robotic, very macho. So this one guy had been on vacation. He came in to see me. He could have read my chart and seen that I was still relatively intact and it could be rehabbed. It's Darwinian. The first 24, 48 hours, they decide which among you should be warehoused and which one of you is worth their time rehabbing. And so I made the Darwinian test, you know. It's very scary. There was a guy in an indie band, I remember, next to me. I think it was Camper Van Beethoven. It was a good band, you know. And Joe was telling me, this guy's had a terrible stroke. He was on stage playing, and he didn't make it. They warehoused him. So I made the cut, thank God. But that was my worst fear, that I wouldn't. And the other people, of course, are more devastated by the stroke. But you still are not sure of how intact you are. You want some encouragement. And this guy came looming over my bed, big guy, barrel-chested, wearing a weird kind of gangster suit with stripes and big lapels. Strange. He had a routine he did with every patient, no matter what condition it were. He would say, what day of the week is it? Who's the president? And what's this? And he would point to the lapel on his suit jacket, which was inordinately wide and out of style. I said, a cheap suit. He pointed out. He said, what? And I said, you're a lapel. But I tell that story in there. But other than him, I have to say the others were angels. And they've come to some of my readings, by the way. City Lights, two of them came to my readings, including Glenn, this wonderful gay nurse. And I have to say, the gay nurses you want to have if you have to be cathetered, because they know their way around a penis, as one said. He said, don't worry, I'm going to lube you so much you won't feel a thing. And it was pretty good. Gay guys tend to be the best with catheters, I have to say. I found it out. Anyway, so Glenn actually tried all sorts of new age things with me. And believe me, at that stage, you want anything. You want acupuncture, in his case, you put gemstones all over me. That felt warm and very comforting. And I lay there, I looked like I was ready for human rituals, human sacrifice. And I remember a doctor coming in and going, whoa, excuse me. Like something very kinky was happening. So every day, I wanted to make that my home. I wanted them to make my family. I wanted those people to know I was human. And they should not just treat me as like some old guy who was ready to be warehoused. So it was important that I also treat them as human and get to know their stories. And so I put on my journalist hat and I interviewed them about who they were, who their families were. I got to know all of them too. And Glenn was one of them. Rebecca Riley is another who came to my book party, who's a speech therapist. And obviously I still have some speech issues, but I couldn't speak at all. when I was first there. And she was so patient with me. She knew I was a newspaper person, a news junkie, and she would bring in newspapers every morning and read to me, and then say, now you read. There's some, obviously, words I still stumble on, but I could barely say anything intelligible. They literally rebuilt me day in and day out, because they said, in their Darwinian way, this guy passes the test, we can rehab him, he has enough left in his brain to work with. But my arm and my whole side was paralyzed, one side. I couldn't walk without, you know, help. So every day I would improve a little more, and by 5 weeks I could pee again before I left the hospital. I was freaked out about that because I couldn't catheter myself. They were trying to teach me because my arm was so dead. It was really half dead. So I didn't want my wife or other people to have to catheter me. I thought that would be really sad. So 2 days in, the bee kicked in. It was like a Christmas present, because right before Christmas. And my mother, who worked with these kidney dialysis kids who couldn't pee on their own, she always would come home. My mother was nuts. And she would say, she would hear us peeing in the bathroom. She said, you don't know how lucky you are. And I always remember that.
I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are listening to a talk that David Talbot gave in Petaluma, California at Copperfields Books. Also a reminder, if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, I have the honor of being in conversation with author, historian, journalist David Talbot. Coming up March 18th in a talk at San Francisco State University, The American Deep State Past and Present, a dialogue with David Talbot and myself, Mickey Huff. Go to projectcensored.org for more information about that. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show. We'll continue with more from David Talbot, Between Heaven and Hell.
Yes.
David, where were you when you had your stroke, and what did it feel like?
I was having dinner with some friends, French restaurant in San Francisco, unassuming bistro, and we're having roast chicken, I remember, nice salad and Chablis. And I thought, I just had one too many glasses of Chablis. I stood up and it was like the lights went out in my head. It was like someone flicked off the lights and then they came back on again. And people saw that I looked weird and they said, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I think I just had a little too much to drink. And they said, well, you shouldn't drive home. But I did, stupidly, while I was in the middle of a stroke. Now, if I had driven on the way home, I passed Davies, where I would actually end up for 5 weeks shortly. If I knew I was having a stroke then, I could have driven myself into the emergency ward and said, I'm having a stroke, give me a clot buster. It's called TPA. It's a pill you take that dissolves the clot that was causing my stroke. And if you take it and it works and it doesn't kill you, because sometimes it causes hemorrhaging and kills you, you have to take the rest. But if it does work, then you're as good as normal. People can't tell anything happened to you. TPA could have saved me from a stroke. And a woman who was a friend of my family read it and was driving on the freeway in Berkeley and had the same symptoms I did and said, I'm having a stroke. And she drove herself to Alta Bates and they did give her TPA. She doesn't want to talk about it or even acknowledge it today, but I've seen her recently and she looks great. So nothing happened to her lasting. Anyway, I waited 24 hours before I realized I was having a stroke. It was the weirdest thing. I went home to bed, woke up the next day, went through a normal day, had no kind of symptoms at all, but I was having what's called a stuttering stroke. It takes 24 to 48 hours to kind of play itself out. And by evening the next night, by around 5 o'clock, almost 24 hours later, I was f***ed up. My wife came home, I was lying in bed, and I was seeing double. I was feeling paralysis on my right side, and I felt otherworldly. It was like being on the weirdest drug you've ever been on. And I said, get me to a hospital. And unfortunately, St. Luke's was the close by hospital. Never go there. It's actually rebranded under a different name, so you can't go there anymore. And they were going to send me home with a case of the flu, they thought. That's how they diagnosed me. 66-year-old man with stroke in his family, with high blood pressure, you know, fit all the profile. Hey, you have the flu. Terrible place. So they needed to get me to the stroke ward at Davies, and that became an ordeal to set that up. But finally, they loaded me into an ambulance. And I was being rushed to the hospital, and this is why it takes a village to save your life sometimes. the ambulance head of that crew was I have to use this word, even though I know it seems anachronistic, he was a man. He was in control. And he heard over his radio, don't bring him in, we don't have a bed. They'd waited so long at St. Luke's to get me over there. By then they were full, so they'd lost my bed. So they said, we can't take him, turn around, take him back. And he could have wimped out and said, okay, I'll do that. He said, I'm 5 minutes away, this man needs care, I'm bringing him in. And they said, no, you can't do that. He said, I'm coming in, and hung up. And he did, and he wheeled me in and banged me through the doors and said, here he is. And I think I'm partly alive because of his steadfastness, whatever it was. I tried to find out the guy, who he was later. And they said they'd put me in touch with him, but they never did. So I hope he reads my book. Yes.
I hope this isn't misunderstood, but when a body part fails, other parts take over. And I wondered if you had much thought about, you know, going from your head to your heart, because it seems like in your writing, you've just developed so much heart. And if in your meditation practice, you consider the word forgiveness, you've tackled so much unforgivable material, that how has the word forgiveness factored into your recovery?
That's a good question. Thanks, Terry. My book, Season of Witch, was written with a kind of love for San Francisco, even though I tell the dark stories too that befell the city. But it's mainly celebrating San Francisco values and how they were brought into the world through struggle and how we liberated a city. I had fun writing. In fact, I can't remember writing the season, which kind of flowed out of me. My other books, Brothers and Devil's Chessboard, about these dark forces that won. They won. We won the culture wars, meaning my left-wing generation, the movement, as we called it. We won. In so many ways we won, ways that our enemies don't win a bet. But we lost the political wars. Donald Trump is our president. So those were written with great anger, I have to say, what happened to America, how we lost our country in the 20th century. That's what I was trying to explain in Brothers and Devil's Chessboard. The bad guys won. So there's no way I could not have written those books in great anger. And unfortunately, a lot of my journalism has been fueled by anger, I think. And after a stroke, to stay that angry would kill me sooner. So I knew that I had to reorient myself and go back to that place of love, because that was part of our generation too, was peace and love. And as I said earlier, I've given up the idea that we're going to change history in a massive way. But I would take pleasure from the smaller victories. My son's film, writing this book, I thought I'd never write again. Seeing people, like old friends I thought I'd never see again, that I'm still here. So I love and appreciate life in a way I don't think I did before. I was so manic, I was so set on goals and deadlines, and we had, you know, Salon had to do this, and we had to do this, and we have to make sure that so-and-so gets elected, and, you know, we have to, like, take power in San Francisco. I was pretty, like, alpha male, and in a way that probably wasn't healthy. And part of it's age, obviously, but part of it is also acknowledging your humanity and your weakness. That was hard to come to, but I can't walk around the city even anymore in the same way. People treat me, they say, oh, sir, can I help you cross the street? I feel like a little old man, you know? And so that depresses you in a way, but also you want to own that and acknowledge what you've become. I remember I was on the set. I wanted to visit the set of Joe's film, even though I couldn't walk very well at that point. And there was an old friend of his who played a small role in the movie. And he saw me walking with a cane up there. And he said, oh, God, Mr. Talbot, I'm so sorry to see you this way. And that is something you don't like to hear, that kind of pity. But at the same time, it was out of love. You have to see, he was saying it out of tenderness for me, like he was commiserating with me. And so it's very important, as I say, not to try to return to your old life. That way lies sadness, disappointment, depression. Ram Dass writes that in his book, your old life is gone forever. My brain surgeon, Michael Key, my good brain surgeon, a wonderful man who I write about in the book, says he's seeing younger and younger stroke patients, patients in their 20s and 30s. They're tech workers who are working 24/7, they're overweight, they have high blood pressure, they're using drugs to fuel themselves, and they stroke out at 28, 29, 30, it's amazing. I was stunned when he said that. He said, yeah, it's more and more common in San Francisco. He said the worst thing for those younger people is they cannot adjust to the fact that they can't code at the same pace they used to code. They have to learn how to be different people, and it's very hard for them. My stroke hit me at a time, fortunately, when I was ready, I think, to become a different person. That's why I say it didn't just change my life, it saved my life. I felt I was dying the first night in the hospital, and I was saying goodbye to everyone around my bedside who loved me. And I was okay with that. I learned that I was okay about accepting death. I always feared death, like everyone. And that night, I realized I gave up my fear of death because I was dying, or at least I felt that. So now I feel that death is the next journey. Maybe that's the end, who knows? I'll just say something that will freak some people out, but I write about it in the book. My mother, obviously, is someone who was very emotionally important to me and very inspirational, and she worked in a hospital ward on the front lines, and I saw her after her death. I went to my dad's apartment in the city we were setting up for, he was moving into a new apartment, and it was the middle of the day, I wasn't on drugs, I wasn't high. I had never seen a spirit like that before, I'd never seen a ghost. And I wasn't distraught about my mother's death because she'd had so much suffering. She'd had several strokes in a row, and she was ready to die. It was a release. So it wasn't like I had a wish fulfillment that I needed to see her again. It was out of the blue. I was in the living room, there was a hallway down to his bedroom, and she was walking around the room to make sure the room was okay for him, because that was how she was. My dad was older, the love of her life. He was a movie star when she was a teenager. She first saw him on the big screen. It was a great romance. It was his fifth marriage. Anyway, she always was looking after my father. So I think she felt really bad about leaving him alone. And so whatever that was, I think I saw into some other plane in that moment. I am a very grounded journalist. I am not religious, not spiritual, but whatever I saw that day suggested to me that this isn't the only reality either. That's why, you know, the Beatles to me, George Harrison and the others who were these spiritual guides to my generation, I was very interested in the way they died. His wife, who was with him as he died, was later on the Martin Scorsese documentary about George Harrison. And she said, if your film crew had been in the room when he died, you wouldn't have needed lights because this light just filled up the room the moment he died. I am just otherworld enough to believe that's true. And actually caregivers, I know palliative caregivers, notice that effect among other people who die. There's a light that goes off at the moment they die. So I don't think we know the full story about the next reality, but I don't need to particularly hold on to that idea to enjoy this life or to be afraid of death. If it is the end and that's all there is and the lights go out, I'm prepared for that too. And that feeling has given me a kind of strength that I never had. And I think a lot of my kind of mania when I was really engaged in journalism and all that came from that fear of death in a way that I was trying to outrun it and trying to make my mark on the world and not think about how it all ended. And now I think about that every day. And so that's why I was thinking about my mother who had to work with dying children every day. Imagine that, children. That's what blows my mind. I mean, for someone my age, that's why I told my family around my bedside, you know, I can go, I'm 66. I've done what I wanted to do. But for kids who were just starting their lives, I couldn't believe how every day of her life she came home and she wasn't depressed, she wasn't moody, she's full of life still. And yet she would say sometimes, well, Tim just died. I'd say, you mean, yeah, that one I told you about, yeah, he just died today. What kind of spirit is there that can absorb that much pain and death every week? So that's why I think I did see her, because that's a pretty strong spirit, you know?
I also go back to that moment, the night of your stroke, where you found that you had no fear of death. I'm fascinated by that moment and whether that had anything to do with what you had accomplished to that point in your life or the relationships you had, or when you think back on it, do you understand why you felt that way?
Yes, I think you put your finger on it, because I felt at that age I had climbed the mountains I wanted to climb. You know, I think Devil's Chessboard should rank as, I have to say, in all humbleness, a masterpiece of history, American history. And it only wasn't treated that way because of what it said, and because it attacked the New York Times and the Washington Post for being complicit in that darkness. And they were. They were propagandists for that particular force, the National Security State, and Alan Dulles in particular, still are. So Anyway, I took some pride in the fact that it was blacklisted by the corporate media, and it still became a New York Times bestseller. So, I'm not angry anymore. No, so I did feel like at that age, I had written the books I needed to write. I'd run a salon and show that you could start an alternative news operation and run it for 10 years. And I felt serene and okay with myself in a way that I could die. It was my family saying I couldn't die that kept me alive. It was my wife and my son. I was saying goodbye, and they said, no, you're not dying. We need you. And that has been sort of more the mantra of my life. I'm here now more because of the people I love, not because I need to accomplish anything more. I was prepared to die that night because, in part, I felt that I could go and be happy about going. But that was being selfish again. I mean, they're basically saying, oh, that's great, you've lived your life, but hey, we need your help. And you know, Joe did need my help. He was about to start shooting a major motion picture, and he was a high school dropout. He needed a dad who didn't die him, because that would have scarred him. I know it would have. He needed to know that his dad was still okay, and that he could talk to me once in a while, even though he's a very self-sufficient guy. So I knew, I looked at their both their faces, my wife and Joe, and I said, yeah, there's other reasons I have to still stick around. That jolted me back. I'll always remember the way they looked when they said that to me. They said so emphatically, you're not dying. You know, it was like the ambulance driver. It was the same thing when he said, I'm bringing him in. It was like, these people are fighting for me, so I gotta fight. That's why I think I say a lot.
Talking about Moroni, of course, really fascinating information that you used for the film. What was it like being a part of that?
So Taghi Amirani is a great Iranian expat filmmaker who's made a wonderful documentary that's like my books, being blocked by the main media. It's called Coup 53. It's about the CIA-sponsored coup in Iran. We're still reaping the tragedy of that terrible event. Still, it poisoned relations between our two countries for decades. So it's a momentous event in 20th century history. And the CIA and Alan Dulles, who ran the CIA, went around bragging about it for years and years. It was one of their greatest achievements. It wasn't. It was one of the greatest tragedies of American history, and most Americans aren't aware of that history. So Taghi, through a very creative way, archival footage, interviewing people who actually were there at the time, and using recreations with actors like Ralph Fiennes, a great British actor, and interviewing people like me who've done books on the subject, and Stephen Kinzer and others. He put together, I think, a masterful documentary. It's creative, it's unusual, it's not sort of a cookie cutter documentary. It's very artistic and very disturbing and very entertaining, if you can say that. So I was proud to be part of that. Walter Murch, who's obviously a big name, worked with Coppola for years, also was a co-producer of that film. And even with that name, Walter Murch, and I saw the movie screened with George Lucas, Francis Coppola, some of the biggest names in Hollywood at the Presidio Theater. You'd think, wow, they have clout to get something distributed. He's calling me up literally 2 weeks ago, can you help me get a distributor for my film? Because my son, he thinks somehow I have connections in Hollywood. You really see how the corporate media is this very powerful bastion that excludes dissident voices, that even beautifully made stuff. And that's why I give a lot of credit to Joe, because in some ways that's a very radical film about gentrification, about how the American dream is impossible for people of color in cities like San Francisco. It says some powerful stuff. And he made that film, and it got seen widely, he got praised widely, he won awards. That takes guts. And so I worry about him sometimes in Hollywood, which is an utter snake pit. Even though I grew up there, my dad was a movie actor, he helped found the Screen Actors Guild. But I know what an awful place it is. It's one of the worst workplaces in America. The sexism, the brutality, the backstabbing, it's just awful. But he as a director has more power than I ever did, because directors of feature films have more power than lowly book authors. Documentary filmmakers, unfortunately, like Taghi, are also, even with Walter Murch co-producing, I'm sorry, but they're kind of sidelined too. So we have to stick together. He's going to Oliver Stone to get him to try and help distribute it. We have to be smart about creating our own networks. And I always believe that. You know, like Scoop Nisker used to say, remember Scoop?
Yeah.
On radio, he said, hey, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. And that's what I love about San Francisco. Paul Kantner, from the Jefferson airplane. One of the great things when I interviewed him, he said, you know, the cool thing about Berkeley versus San Francisco is Berkeley always was protesting and saying what they didn't like. We here in San Francisco, we just went and made a new reality. And he said, you know, San Francisco is 7x7 surrounded by reality. So we built our own reality, you know, the food co-ops, the free clinics, Haight-Ashbury Clinic, Digger closed doors, theater groups, media, underground radio, underground comics, Zap Comics, my friend, old friend Spain Rodriguez and R. Crumb. That, to me, that's why I had to write Season of the Witch. When you liberate a city, you have to build a new reality. You don't just replace it with the same old, same old. We brought a whole new culture, and that's really important. And that's what we need to do today. America just can't get rid of Trump. We have to make a whole new culture beyond Trump. And that's why I love, most of all, when I go to see these young groups. They've got a whole different consciousness, and that's what we need now. Yes?
I just wanted to ask about A Man's Search for Meaning, and then you mentioned, did your perspective toward it change?
You know, books have a habit of jumping in front of your eyes at the right time sometimes. I led Devil's Chessboard with an epigram from an Eric Ambler novel, and I'd never really read Eric Ambler. He was a mystery writer in England from the 30s and 40s, but he had a beautiful quote in one murder mystery that I read, that it's not the guy who fires the bullet, it's who bought the bullet, it's the person who bought the bullet. And that's, of course, Alan Dulles' story. It's not whoever is committing the violent act, it's who's sponsoring it. And that's who Alan Dulles, as head of the CIA, was. And with Viktor Frankl, I remember the new version of the book, it was sitting at the bookstore in Noe Valley. It was a staff pick, so staff picks are very important. And it's a thin book, it's a small book, but it was very artfully done and looked nice on the shelf. And I'd always heard about it, but I never read it. And I was starting to write my memoir. I picked it up, and I've always been intrigued, I guess like my mother, in this chamber of death, you know, the kidney dialysis unit, children's hospital. I've also been obsessed with what survivors at concentration camps must have gone through, and what kind of spirit they had to survive that horror. And I remember as a kid seeing Night and Fog. They showed it to us in high school. I never got those images out of my mind. So I remember the story that he wrote that stuck with me, Frankl. I write the whole thing in the book. It wasn't just you have the right, the freedom to choose your attitude. It was how we led into the story. So he said in his camp, I think it was Auschwitz, there were a few souls, as he put, a few men, who had just a few crusts of bread that they were all living on, and they were all given their rations, and they walked through the camp giving their rations to other people. So they're basically sacrificing themselves so others could live. And then he said, you have one freedom left to you, as those men did. They have the freedom to choose what you do in your last hours on earth. So that was their choice, to help others. So again, what kind of inordinate humanity it takes to do something that brave. We all want to be inspired by people and by acts of heroism. I love movies about heroism, books. They inspire me. That's why I love to read about how George Harrison died, for instance, how people you love and admire died, because you want to learn the lessons of their death, because we all need that guidance. And I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I'm sure many of you read this after my father died. I think our society spends too much time repressing the idea of death, and as a result, we don't live fully. It's a strange contradiction, and that's why I was bringing up my mother. I can't imagine a more bawdy, lusty, loving, life-loving, affirming woman. I've never met one. She had this amazing hug. It was like she was breathing life into you. She was really kind of racy. She had a big cucumber and making salad. She would hold up the cucumber, and we were all like little kids, you know. She'd go, oh, reminds me of my first husband. She was really nuts. But then she would go with these kids who were dying the next day. It was so crazy. Anyway, yes, Mickey.
What might be next as far as your writing and your journalism?
I'm under contract to write one more book. In fact, when I had my stroke, I was in the middle of this other book. It was my editor's idea at HarperCollins. And she admired Joseph Ellis's book, Founding Brothers, which was a series of portraits of six or seven of the key founding fathers. And not just portraits of them, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and so on, but of moments, key moments in their lives where they changed their lives and the lives of American history. So she said, what if you pick six or seven revolutionaries from the second American Revolution in the 60s and 70s and wrote about these epiphanies in their lives that changed history? And I thought that was a good idea. I did pick about seven or eight people I thought would be great. And I didn't want to write big, full-fledged books anymore. I wanted to write stories. And I love the idea of a key moment. So like in Dennis Banks' American Indian Movement, co-founder with Russell Means, it was at Wounded Knee in 73, this amazing showdown where the American Indians announced themselves, we're not all dead, we're still here. And we're going to take this ground where they massacred hundreds of us back in the 19th century. It was this amazing symbolic moment. And it's just like Standing Rock, they totally militarized it right away. FBI, armed to the teeth, sheriffs, cops, military, tanks, the same thing as Standing Rock back in 1973, Nixon was president. And for, I forget how many days, 90 days or longer, they held out. They poured gunfire. I mean, the amount of gunfire they poured into these little shacks in the church where these women, men, and children, entire families were huddled. It was like Vietnam. They did kill two or three members of the occupation. But on the final day, they'd worked out a surrender. They were going to keep their pride. And Russell Means was already out. He was in jail. But Dennis Banks knew they were going to kill him. The word came back, they're going to kill you on a pretext. They'll say you're trying to escape and they'll shoot you in the back. You know. We've seen this millions of times in America. And then they killed Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader, in his bit. So they were doing it quite easily. So Dennis Banks knew he had to be smuggled out that night, or he was going to be taken out and chained like another humiliated American Indian chief, like Sitting Bull, and then assassinated. So how would they slip him past this iron ring? So I interviewed Dennis right before he died, and then I interviewed Lenny Foster, who was the young American Navajo who led him out. And that escape, Dennis Banks' escape to freedom and to fight another day, as he put it, was, I thought, so heroic. And such a great story. So that's just one example of the things I'm going to do in this new book. I picked eight great leaders, able to interview some of them before they died. And I told the one story that I wanted to inspire people today and say, look, if they could do this, we can do this, no matter Trump or anything else. Yeah. Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why
you've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I founded this program back in 2010. We're on close to 50 stations around the United States now. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. We got that love of the brothers in